Here on a special edition of the Road to 100 podcast, I'm TJ Katz, your 99th Grand Isle of Cadol, and I am so excited to be joined by 99-year-old alumnus of AZA, Bill Schrimmer.
Bill, can you tell us about what it was like to be a Jewish teen during World War II?
It's difficult to describe because you went through several conditions. And the war broke out in Europe in 1939, September 3rd. It so happened I was with my son, my brother, who's 10 years younger. I was with him for the walk. All of a sudden, the siren sounded, and we ran like other people did. We didn't know why, and we found out the war had broken out. So we called friends and we started to get in touch with each other and try to console each other that it isn't that bad, it's just sirens. But otherwise we sort of kept to ourselves very much. My little kid brother was put into school, and I had to start working for a Jewish grocer who understood my German because he spoke Yiddish. And I had to deliver, I had to make deliveries to Jewish people with kosher food, and they treated me very nicely. They gave me tips, and so I spent a few months delivering food. Then after a while, and it became a little difficult because we had bombing raids started up, and we had to stay indoors. Mm-hmm. And I lost touch with most of the people that I had in the meantime made friends with. Mm-hmm. And I was taken in the middle of May, I was taken to a staging area, Kensington Park in London. I lived in London, and I was taken by two Grenadier guards who happened to have come back from the war in Europe. They were on leave, and they didn't treat me very nicely. They were at 6 foot something, and they marched me downtown into London, and there I met other people. Jewish, mostly Jewish refugees like myself, mm-hmm. but all older. I was only 16 at the time, and I must have been one of the youngest ones that was taken in for intern. And from there, with other Jewish people, we got into wagons, car wagons, and we were sent to Liverpool. Mm-hmm. And that was at the camp below Liverpool, where we ended up in tents. And I was together in one tent with seven others. All were Austrians. I was the only German Jew. But we conversed, we talked, and life was very simple there. They didn't treat us too well, the guards. It was a wild compound. And Jewish life as such, it came kind of a standstill. Life became very difficult too. Once in a while you had to go out to the out, and you had to climb over several feet, and somebody get annoyed, and when you get out of your tent, all of a sudden the guards would show up and say, "Stop there, where are you going?" And then I had to go to the latrine, and I came back and I woke him up again, and that was a little hard. But as far as I said, as far as Jewish life is concerned, I have to say it was very little observed. Mm-hmm. Until finally my father was interned on the Isle of Man in one of the towns there. And my mother finally got through to the interior minister, and I was able to be shipped from Liverpool to the Isle of Man to join my father. And life was much better. We were in hotels, like our room, and life was better. And there, some intellectual life began. We have a famous professor. We had famous musicians and others that gave lectures, and we learned. But they were all Jews. These were strictly Jewish internees. But first, religious-wise, again, there was not much activity. And finally, in November, I was released from camp. And I came home, and thereon, I lived on without really practicing Jews. We had two synagogues nearby where we went for the high holidays.
Sure. And what can you share with us about your family escaping from Germany and what that process was like for you and them?
After the Kristallnacht, at 2:30 in the morning, the Gestapo knocked on the door and asked my father to pick up his few things that he needs. And he went to the Buchenwald concentration camp with his brother. They both owned our factory and other assets. And luckily enough, my uncle and my father were well-to-do at the time, and they were given an opportunity to be released from the camp, provided they would transfer all our assets, to the German government. So in order to be able to come out of the camp willingly, and not knowing that the future wasn't Germany anymore for us, they signed it over to the government, and they were released. And then after that, immediately, my father made plans to be able to come to America. My father made all the arrangements by himself, and to this day, I cannot understand how my father, he was around 50 at the time, was able to handle all these difficulties we had in order to get out of Germany. And I'm just amazed. Sure. One of the things was that when we were out of Dresden, we ended up in Berlin for a night. And from there, my father arranged for us to go to Hamburg. And we were able to get into a German steamer that headed for Southampton, England. And how he managed to overcome all difficulties, I don't know. But he managed it. And this is why I think our lives were spared to the ingenuity of my dad, who was able to accomplish that. And that when we arrived in Southampton, a rather poor great uncle of mine met us. He lived up in a loft, and his apartment was two ropes across the room where he hung his clothes and where his dishes and everything. But he helped us settle in London. We had no money, and we were serviced by two London Jewish organizations. One was called the Bloomsbury House, and I don't know what the other one is. I don't remember at the moment the name of the other one. But they helped us get through it food-wise and living-wise until things started to get better, where we were able to get work, where we were able to go to work. And my father, he's very entrepreneur. He always was up. When he was down, he was up again. Mm-hmm. And he opened a little business for himself, and where my mother helped out. And in the meantime, of course, we had the air raids coming in. And he decided to get a shelter in the house. He bought a heavy steel plate, which was, the legs were angle iron. They was welded together. And at night, during air raids, my father and mother slept under there. And there were others living with us. We had our own living. And the moment we heard the air raid sirens go, we all crawled under the shelter until the all clear was done. Yeah. And this was how we had to live under the circumstances. Food was rationed. We had very little butter and so forth. So we had to live through this for the years until 1945, when the war ended.
Sure. And can you talk a little bit more about how you got involved with BBYO once you moved to England?
Okay, I have to go back now. My father was a member of a B'nai B'rith Lodge way back in the 1920s, perhaps, or even before. And I heard a few things once in a while. They took us out. We had a summer home, the congregation. And we went there once in a while, and we met people, and we went swimming and so forth. But I always knew about the B'nai B'rith. So when the things happened that we had to get out of Germany, we ended up in London. My father and other refugees, when time came, they formed a B'nai B'rith Lodge called the Leo Beck Lodge of London, named after the chief rabbi of Germany who survived the war. And we were youngsters, in our, late teens, early 20s perhaps. We met as children of the Lodge brothers. And then the decision was made to form a chapter of the BYO. And we made a request to Washington, and we told them that we were a small group of less than 20, and we were of men and women, and we would like to have a single charter if possible. And the B'nai B'rith Washington, BBYO in Washington, they issued one charter, and that's how the group started.
Sure.
So that's how I was, that's where my B'nai B'rith BBYO
emerged. Yes. And could you share a little bit more about your chapter, Otto Hirsch? What were the types of things you did and all of that?
Okay. We were able to get the Leo Beck Lodge in London had certain quarters on Baker Street in London. I don't know if anybody knows about Sherlock Holmes, but Sherlock Holmes was on Baker Street, right?
Yes.
Okay. Anyway, they had, that was a synagogue, kind of a synagogue. It was like, it looked like a building, but it was a synagogue. And they lent their space for the lodge and also for us, the BBYM. And we met there once a month. And every time we met, one of our members had to bring a program. Even once in a while, he brought a speaker. And sometimes we had just a cordial get-together where we shared experiences.
Yeah.
And we also decided to make a little more use of our weekends. And we made arrangements to get out of London. It was towards the end of the war, but it was still wartime. And we went to hostels. We arranged with hostels to take us overnight. And we slept in dorms, the men in one dorm and the women in another dorm. And in the morning we got up and we went into the woods or wherever we wanted to go. And we had a wonderful time. We also, I think I mentioned it before, we also once went to Stratford-on-Avon, which is Shakespeare's home. Yeah. And one Saturday we decided to take in two programs, and we bought tickets for the matinee in the afternoon and also for the evening.
Sure.
And as a matter of fact, I remember the plays that were shown, and one was called Love's Labour's Lost, and the other was called The Tempest. And to the end of my life, I don't know how much I have left, but to the end of my life, I'll never forget. That's then my mayor. But we made other trips. So that's how we managed to spend our get-togethers.
That's amazing. And as you were part of BBYO as a teen and still involved with B'nai B'rith later in life as well, how have you felt that BBYO really shaped your teenage years? And to this day, in what ways do you feel BBYO has impacted you?
Well, I would say a lot of camaraderie. Because England was at war, and there wasn't that much availability for us to do, so we sort of stuck to each other, and it was a very close-knit group. But outside of that, really, we all worked. I was the only one that wasn't able to go to college. All the others, they all went to night school, and as a matter of fact, when I came to the States, I contacted the B'nai B'rith, the president, and I asked him if BBYO, if there were ever any members that joined the Leo Beck Lodge there. And he wrote back, yes, there's one person by the name of Friedland, I think it was name, who is still alive, and he was trying to contact him to contact me, but it failed. So that was my end of contact with with England. And here we called ourselves the Young Couples Group because we were older already. These were the offsprings of the German refugees that formed the London, the New Beck Lodge in New York. And we called ourselves the Young Couples Group, even though most of us were single. But we got together. Mm-hmm. But somehow, I don't know why, the thought never occurred, maybe we were too old already, to apply for BBYO membership. I really don't know why. I wouldn't able to tell you why we didn't follow up on that. But when I moved to New Jersey, by the way, my late wife was also, I'm a life member of B'nai B'rith. And my wife joined when I met her. It's an interesting story how I met my wife. Would you like to hear it?
Sure.
Okay. During the time spent in, first of all, when we left London, I left all the friends behind. Mm-hmm. And when we came to New York, and it was one of the worst summers in 1947, one of the worst summers in New York. And I said, this is not for me. I walked the streets. Mm-hmm. I wanted to get back. But eventually I made friends, and I had a girlfriend. And one day the girlfriend, we walked together, and she looked at the house and said, oh, I'm going to go upstairs. I'm going to visit my girlfriend. Would you like to come along? And I said, sure, why not? To make a long story short, this girlfriend, her girlfriend became my girlfriend, who I eventually married.
Sure.
And we were married for 72 years. I lost my wife almost 3 years ago. But we had a wonderful life together. And what I'm coming back to now is she joined the Leo Beck Lodge Women's, auxiliary. Mm-hmm. And she also became a life member, but she was there years. And when we moved away from New York, many others from our group had moved into communities.
Yeah.
And we lost kind of contact. I still got mail from them, from those that were left behind, but we lost contact. So I lost contact with B'nai B'rith, BBYO, and suddenly it occurred to me, why not? I got people, I don't know how they got my name. I wrote to Washington quite a few times, trying to get attention, but it hadn't been for Debbie, maybe, I don't know. I would still be looking around trying to find somebody that can help me because I wanted to reestablish my contact with BBYO.
Sure. And I mean, on that note, so many years later, after you've finished your formal involvement with BBYO, what's really sparked your interest in wanting to be back, wanting to get involved, reaching out so much, and still being in the thick of it?
It's easy to say, it's just hard to find the words for it.
Of course.
Okay. Basically what it is this was a group I felt very comfortable in, and I felt like at home. That's why when I greeted you guys coming here, I mean, it was a touching moment to
Absolutely.
See you guys. Nothing bad that I want to say about Debbie. I'm glad Debbie, she was the one who engineered all this. Okay, if it hadn't been for Debbie, I might still be out on the soccer field. I don't know. But anyway, when you came, when I met you, when I know of you, it came back memories which to me are very dear.
Absolutely.
Yes.
That's excellent. And sort of what advice do you have to others, other alumni who have finished their teenage years in BBYO? What do you recommend to them? How can they stay involved with all of it? How can they possibly reconnect with BBYO in the ways that you're now reconnecting with it?
When I go to bed at night, I'm going to talk a little bit too personal perhaps, but I'm going to do it anyway. I try to reflect, and I'm also grateful that I'm where I am today. And I never forget that it happens every night.
Absolutely.
And then I reflect. And I reflect that when I was a little guy, I was helped along to grow up without a mother. And then I met good friends in my school who turned Nazis past them. and despised me, hit me, and others who are my good friends, they were afraid if they would find out that they're friendly towards me, that they would get into trouble. So I was a little bit a loner, I would say. And then towards the end, I met other people, other friends, made other friends. But in the whole life, really, it's always came back to the same, that I felt I was mostly at home in my group. And, it's always a tunnel. It's always the end of the tunnel. So through all the hard life that I went through, I always looked at for that light. And if I hadn't been in England for the 7 years, it would have been 2 years, I wouldn't be here today. Because I would have never met my wife, and my life would have been very different. So as much as I downgraded my life having to move to America, I always looked for that light and the tunnel. And I did find it. I have a wonderful family. I have two wonderful children who each have three great-grandchildren. Some of them have two children, and I have over five and a half great-grandchildren. And to me, having to be forced out of England, which I didn't want to leave, and come to the States where I didn't want to end, in the end, everything opened up for me. And this is where I say, if you have illicit desperation, you always think there's always something green ahead of you. And for me, it's having that family. That's the greatest thing that happened to me, and I'm so glad that the good Lord allows me to be that old in order to enjoy that company. I love you guys.
Absolutely. And as my co-president Courtney and I are traveling the world over this next year, getting to meet with thousands of Jewish teens from every corner of the globe, what lessons do you think that we should instill in them? What should we teach them about? How can we really help them to celebrate their Judaism and the camaraderie that you mentioned and really help guide them with that?
Well, I think I don't want to go back what I just said, but there's always something ahead of you that you can achieve, that you're looking for, whether it's in religion or in other areas. I don't want to point out, but of course, as Jews, in the Jewish ways, we, in spite of Hitler and other deprivations, we never lost our Judaism. I tell you honestly, I considered myself, like through my family, as German by nationality and Jews by religion. And whether it's right or wrong, whether I have criticism on that, this is how I made my life. That I figured my religion is being a Jew by observing to the holidays to great degrees, that I'm Jewish and I'm proud of it, and nothing can shake me from that. But the nationality, that's just something else. So here I am suggesting that you're a good citizen, but don't lose your Jewish heritage, which is very important.
Absolutely. Going into our centennial year as an organization and celebrating the 100th year of AZA, what is it that you recommend to young Jewish men from all over the world as advice as they're growing, maturing, and moving on?
Well, if they have lived through the AZA and BBYG life and enjoyed and found certain things of value, they should increase this value. Stay with it, but increase it. And your horizon is wide. When you're young, I was restricted because of conditions. But these young people have all the world ahead of them. And if they are desperate to achieve that, they can achieve it. But of course, being Jewish, you never lose your Jewish heritage, and keep that. And keep that.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you.